watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Politicians routinely campaign on being tough on crime and demand that citizens take personal responsibility. Pay-ins to the so-called rule of law as a bulwark against tyranny are a staple of mainstream political rhetoric of both parties. To what extent does this rhetoric reflect the reality of the conduct of our nation towards other nations, or the government towards its citizens? As we'll hear tonight on the program, in actual practice, obedience to laws is only for the poor and the weak. Might makes right. For the first 90 minutes of the program, we'll hear a recent speech by Professor Noam Chomsky on the U.S. government's selective adherence to international laws concerning human rights and war crimes. Then we'll take a look at the function of laws inside our borders with a talk by Christian Parenti, focusing on the history of federal crime legislation as a means of social control of poor and working people. Talk by Professor Noam Chomsky was given on December 6th for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's program on human rights and justice.
Well, as you know, I'm sure, December 10th is the anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's recognized properly, I think, as the human rights standard. It's part of what's called customary international law, recognized by U.S. courts. As in the case of other elements of international law, there is no enforcement mechanism apart from the hardly satisfactory mechanism that's provided by the operative principle of international affairs, namely the rule of force. The point was expressed, captured rather accurately by a 17th century popular poet. He described laws as like spider webs. He said, lesser flies are quickly taken while the great break out again, which incidentally rhymes in 17th century English. But you get the point. In this respect, human rights conventions are, and international law in general, are quite different from the so-called free trade agreements, or what the Wall Street Journal more honestly calls free investment agreements. For these, they impose harsh sanctions for non-compliance. That's a crucial part of the World Trade Organization regime. Here, too, in fact, the great break out again when they choose. But the sanctions do exist, and they're sometimes applied. In contrast, human rights conventions carry no penalties at all for violation. That distinction reflects the ranking of the rights of investors versus the rights of ordinary people in the prevailing doctrinal systems. It's one of many illustrations of that same fact, of the rule of force in international affairs. Another illustration of that is prosecution for war crimes or crimes against humanity. In this case, only the weak and the defeated need apply. Furthermore, that's a matter of principle. It was explained rather clearly by Telford Taylor. He was the chief counsel for the prosecution at Nuremberg. About 30 years ago, he wrote a book, some of you will remember, on Nuremberg and Vietnam, in which he raised the question whether the Nuremberg principles would apply to the U.S. conduct of the war in Vietnam. And in it, he considered the question whether the bombing of North Vietnam can be counted a war crime. He recognized and reported that the bombing was devastating near the major urban centers where there were diplomats and journalists and Russian ships in the harbor and so on. There was a certain degree of protection, but elsewhere, you don't have to go very far away to see that much of the country was turned into a moonscape, particularly below the 20th parallel. And Taylor was well aware of that, but he pointed out, and quite accurately, that aerial bombardment, no matter how devastating, is not a war crime by the standards of Nuremberg. And he also gave the reasons, as, quote him, he said, "The Allies had played the terrible game even more successfully than the Germans, and therefore it would have been inequitable to charge the Nazis with crimes." Of course, it would have been equitable to charge everyone with crimes, but that was never considered, and he doesn't mention that possibility. Similarly, he points out that German admirals were exonerated from war crimes on the basis of testimony by U.S. Admiral Nimitz, who testified that the U.S. Navy had committed the same crimes, so therefore they weren't crimes. The operational definition of a war crime, as according to the Nuremberg principles, are that war crimes are crimes that somebody else committed against us, but that we didn't commit against them, or at least we can claim we didn't. In this respect, war crimes are very much like terrorism. Terrorism is terrorism that's carried out by them against us, whoever we happen to be. Our crimes are, in contrast, self-defense. Again, that holds whoever we happen to be. You can try it out. I think you'll find that it's a historical universal. And it's transmuted by power into history in another, in a very specific way. That's another near universal. Notice that Taylor was talking about crimes in North Vietnam, bombing of North Vietnam. He never raised the question of the bombing of South Vietnam, which was far more intense and destructive and began much earlier. South Vietnam was also subjected to lots of other crimes that were never used in the North. For example, chemical warfare, plenty of people still dying from it. Destruction of dams, it's another war crime under Nuremberg principles. And lots of other crimes. But the South was completely defenseless, so therefore the attackers are totally immune, at least within their own doctrinal systems, ours. So there was no protest. In contrast, the North had some defenses. As I mentioned, there was an international presence, and also they had anti-aircraft weapons supplied by the Russians, which was condemned here as a crime of the Russians, but the South was totally defenseless, and therefore the attack is completely carried out with total impunity. There was never much of an issue, the bombing of South Vietnam, even in the peace movement. There was almost no protest prior to 1965. That was before the bombing of North Vietnam started, when it was only the South that was getting destroyed and hundreds of thousands of people killed. So that wasn't a case of protest, again, because it was defenseless. One of the most interesting aspects of the Pentagon Papers is a comparison of the planning for bombing of the North and the South. With regard to the bombing of the North, if you read through the internal documents, there's very meticulous, careful planning, just how far can you go without too much of a cost and so on. In the case of the bombing of the South, there's nothing. No, there's just no planning. You just announce, every once in a while you announce it or do it. But that makes sense because there's no cost. So therefore, it's completely free. You can bomb at will. And the same is true of the huge literature on the war in Vietnam. It's enormous. But it almost never raises the question of the bombing of South Vietnam or any other major atrocities carried out in the South, because they're just normal. They're costless, and therefore they carry no stigma. These are facts that tell you quite a lot about the values that we're supposed to uphold, and all are matters that bear quite directly on the question of human rights and international law, in the real world. Another illustration of that, current illustration, is given, again, pretty graphically by the two major crimes that brought the 20th century to a kind of a fitting end. One is the Serbian crimes in Kosovo. The other are the simultaneous Indonesian crimes in East Timor. By any reasonable standard, the second are far worse, but only the first is punished, or for that matter even investigated. So immediately after the bombing of Serbia ended, Kosovo was teeming with investigators, forensic investigators, attempting to find any shred of evidence they could about crimes that could be attributed to the Serbs. But forensic investigators were withheld from East Timor, despite the pleas of the United Nations, Timorese, and others. Why the difference? Well, it's pretty simple. In East Timor, the crimes can be traced right back to Washington and London, very easily, in fact, and they are, of course, immune by virtue of the rule of force, so therefore inquiry would be totally inappropriate, and the lack of inquiry, again, passes without notice. Similarly, there's a huge literature and vast indignation about Kosovo, but virtually nothing about East Timor, and that little is never reviewed or mentioned. And again, that reflects the same distinction. If 80,000 Kosovars were right now rotting in Serbian concentration camps, many dying every day, we'd know about it. In fact, we'd probably go to war. That's in fact happening right now with regard to the Timorese, but there's total silence, and for the same reasons. In fact, even the case of Kosovo reflects those crucial distinctions. So if you have a look, say, at the indictment of Milosevic for crimes in Kosovo, the indictment is interesting. The crimes are virtually without exception. The crimes that he's charged with are after the bombing, and it's surely in reaction to it. The reason for that, the indictment was based on the very rich record of U.S. and British intelligence. By now, a lot of that's been made public, including a ton of other documentation from NATO and State Department and other Western sources. And it reveals is very clear. Up until a couple of months before the bombing, about January, the British, who were the super hawks in the alliance, attributed most of the crimes there to the rebels, to the guerrillas attacking Kosovo from across the border. And in the months that followed, nothing changed, at least according to the voluminous record that's provided by the West. For this reason, this entire documentary record, which is extremely rich, is totally ignored in the literature on the topic. Take a look and see. But because then, after the bombing, or after the withdrawal of the monitors under by the U.S. over Serbian objections, and then the bombing immediately, then the crimes really start. So that's what the indictment is. Of course, there's a small corollary to that. It means that the responsibility for those crimes is actually shared, since they're a direct consequence of the bombing. It doesn't exonerate the crimes, but tells you a little about the responsibility. But none of this is mentionable either. This is off the record for the same reasons. What about NATO war crimes? They certainly took place during the bombing, but they can't be investigated either. The International Tribunal did briefly make some gestures about investigating them, but they were quickly called off. The reasons were explained rather neatly by a U.S. senator who was asked about it on a visit to Canada. He said he was asked what would happen if the International Tribunal investigated NATO crimes in the bombing of Serbia, and he pointed out that if that ever happened, the United Nations buildings in New York would be taken apart brick by brick and thrown into the Atlantic Ocean, which sort of captures the point pretty accurately. That again captures the essence of international law in the real world. Well, it's easy enough to continue, and I won't go on with that. But these are background realities that we just can't ignore. in considering human rights and international law, at least if we're trying to be serious about the topic. For the same reasons, the doctrines and the practices of the United States are of paramount importance for the entire world. Economically speaking, the world is kind of tripolar, as it's called, with three major power centers, roughly comparable in Asia, Europe, and North America. But in terms of the means of violence, it's radically unipolar. It's all concentrated in one place. And that means what happens there is of enormous significance for everyone. And most emphatically, it's of enormous significance for us for two obvious reasons. For one thing, we happen to be here, so therefore we're responsible for what happens. And for another, happens to be a country that's remarkably free by comparative standards. So therefore, what we do or what we don't do has a very great impact, and it follows that the moral responsibility is comparably great. Again, if we're trying to be serious, if we want to join the mainstream, we pick a different perspective, the opposite one. Again, a historical universal. Well, assuming elementary moral principles, let's take a look at the official U.S. attitudes towards international law and human rights, and then a little bit of corresponding practice. With regard to international law, there's no ambiguity at all. The attitude is very clear. Perhaps the clearest example, which happens to be highly pertinent right now for a number of reasons, is a Security Council resolution of 1986. The resolution called on all states to observe international law. That's it. It was vetoed by the United States, which therefore stands alone in declaring that states, meaning one state, doesn't have to observe international law. That was then reiterated at the General Assembly for successive years. The votes were again almost unanimous. The United States and one or two client states opposed. In these resolutions, no state was mentioned, but everybody knew who was meant. It was intended, it was aimed at the United States, and the reason was because of the judgment of the International Court of Justice, the World Court, shortly before, which had condemned the United States for the unlawful use of force, meaning international terrorism, in its war against Nicaragua. The United States, incidentally, stands alone in the world in having been condemned by the World Court for international terrorism, and by the Security Council in the follow-up resolution that it it vetoed. So it's entirely natural that the United States should be lauded now for leading the war against terrorism, without any reference to any of this, of course. The reason for rejecting the World Court decision, it wasn't just a decision. They ordered the U.S. to desist, to pay reparations. The reaction was to immediately escalate the war. The reason for the rejection of World Court jurisdiction was explained by the State Department legal officer, Abraham Sofer. He reviewed the history of the relation between the United States and the international institutions. He pointed out, he did it accurately, he said that right after the Second World War, we could count on other countries to go along with anything we did. They'd vote with us at the United Nations and so on, for pretty obvious reasons, which he didn't explain, and you don't have to. But as decolonization set in and the United Nations began to reflect a wider range of opinion, and as Europe and Japan were reconstructed from the war, the United Nations stopped being a reliable instrument of support for U.S. actions. And as a result, he said, we can no longer count on other nations of the world to go along with us when we do something, and therefore we must reserve to ourselves the right to determine when some action is within the domestic jurisdiction of the United States. In this case, the act that was within the domestic jurisdiction of the United States was a terrorist war against Nicaragua. These things ought to be taught in elementary school, in my opinion. They're very great significance for anyone who wants to understand anything about ourselves, which is presumably an important topic. They certainly ought to be headlines right now. It's all very pertinent. For one thing, because the reason I already mentioned, the one state that has declared its immunity to international law and has been condemned for international terrorism, is now leading the war on terrorism without any comment. For another, because the actions that Nicaragua took in this case do serve as a precedent as to how to respond to acts of international terrorism, and recall that that was far worse even than the events of September 11th. There are methods to respond by law-abiding states. Nicaragua pursued them, obviously couldn't get anywhere. It was up against a power that doesn't observe any of these rules. But if the United States wanted to pursue those paths, nothing would block it. It was a decision not to pursue them. Well, that's not the only case, neither the first nor the last. Just to take another, there's no one in the United States who's more lauded more effusively for his defense of international law, his lonely battle for international law, than Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Article after article, biography just came out last year, which emphasizes it. When he resigned from the Senate a year ago, there was an accolade in the New York Times Magazine by a left liberal writer, Jacob Weisberg, who again praised him for standing up for international law and fighting this lonely, courageous battle at the United Nations, where he was U.S. representative for a while, and he emphasized particularly his tremendous courage in criticizing Idi Amin and defending Israel. That takes a lot of courage in New York. The biography does the same thing. Always pointedly omitted in all of these accolades and praises is the most important action that Moynihan took while he was U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and which he's quite proud of. He describes it in his memoirs. The action, it's actually the most important act of his life in terms of its human consequences by far. The act had to do with the Indonesian invasion of East Timor in December 1975. The invasion was immediately condemned by the Security Council in a resolution unanimously passed calling on Indonesia to terminate the war crime, which is what it is, and the crimes against humanity which immediately followed, and to withdraw from East Timor. But nothing ever happened, and Moynihan explains why in his memoirs. I'll read it in his words. He said, "The United States wished things to turn out as they did and worked to bring this about. The Department of State desired that the United Nations prove utterly ineffective in whatever measures it undertook. This task was given to me, and I carried it forward with no inconsiderable success." Well, that's true. He also understands the success. He pointed out right away that within the next couple of months, about 60,000 people were killed. And he says it must have ended at that point because it disappeared from the media, which it did, while another 200,000 or so were killed with U.S. arms flowing in and then the British taking over when the genocide, that's what it was, really reached a peak, going on until 1999, as I mentioned. Like the remarks of Sofair, these ought to also be committed to memory by anyone who's concerned with international law or human rights, and for that matter, anyone who values their freedom. And it's telling that it's expunged from history, like Sofair's remarks, in fact, like all of these events, in fact, everything I've mentioned, out of history, wrong story. Well, again, those are historical universals are pretty close when countries are powerful enough to get away with it, and when the intellectual culture is subservient enough to play that game, as it usually is. Actually, none of this is really left to inference. It's all stated pretty clearly. So Dean Acheson, elder statesman who was an advisor to the Kennedy administration, gave an important talk before the American Society of International Law in 1963, in which he explained, I'll quote him, that if there is a challenge to the power, position, and prestige of the United States, then the propriety of the U.S. response is not a legal issue. He said that international law has its points. He said it's useful to gild our positions with an ethos derived from very general moral principles which have affected legal doctrines, but that's it. It's not to be adhered to be used as a weapon or to gild our positions. The supreme cynicism of these remarks derives from authentic power. For someone like Acheson, there's no need to resort to the kinds of pretenses that deface intellectual journals, journals of opinion, commentary generally, academic writing, and so on. And he can just tell the truth, and nobody cares. That's good. He should. You know, nice to hear it straight out of the horse's mouth. The internal record, if you bother to look at it, is exactly the same. And that goes way back to the beginning. The National Security Council was established in 1947, just at the time of the founding of the United Nations and the UN Charter, which outlawed the threat of use of force in international affairs. The first memorandum of the National Security Council in 1947 was concerned with Italy. There was a lot of worry about Italy at the time. There was a powerful anti-Nazi resistance in Italy, worker-based, in fact liberated most of the country. It's the first act of the British and the Americans who entered Italy from the south and then went up to the north was to dismantle the resistance and to restore the fascist structures. But still, they were the labor-based resistance movement was quite strong and had a lot of prestige. There was an election coming up in 1948, and it was very likely that the communists who were based on it would win the election, which caused a lot of problems. That's what NSC 1 was about. At that point, the U.S. thought it probably had a way to control the elections, namely by withholding food. The country was starving, by reinstating the fascist police to break strikes and so on. It was all pretty powerful weapons. But they weren't sure they were going to work. So NSC 1 discusses what would happen if the communists took power by legal means in a democratic election. And it determines, this is internal records, later declassified, that in that case, the U.S. would declare a national emergency, put the Sixth Fleet in the Mediterranean on alert, and begin to support paramilitary activities inside Italy to overthrow the government. That's NSC 1, exactly at the time when the U.S. and other countries were declaring solemnly that the threat of or use of force in international affairs is illegitimate. Not everyone agreed. In the internal deliberations, George Kennan, who's considered the leading humanist in the system, he was opposed to that because he thought they ought to take much harsher measures. He thought that they ought to carry out these measures even before the election, just not to take a chance. But he was sort of quieted down and convinced that other measures like starvation and violence would probably work to swing the election, as indeed they did. Well, that's NSC 1, and the practice continues. We've actually just seen a rather striking example of it, namely the bombing of Afghanistan. Rather pointedly, the United States did not request, in fact, refused to request Security Council authorization for that, which would have made it legitimate. Right or wrong is another question, but legitimate at least within the framework of international law. There's a lot of debate about whether the ambiguous resolutions actually justify the bombing, but it's all beside the point because it all could have been clarified very easily just by asking for a resolution to endorse the bombing, which would have certainly passed. The five countries with a veto wouldn't have vetoed it. Britain reflexively goes along with the United States. France has enough of an imperial legacy so that it certainly wouldn't object to bombing some third world country. As for Russia and China, they're very enthusiastic about the bombing because they're seeking U.S. endorsement and authorization for their own massive atrocities in Chechnya and western China. So therefore, they're delighted in principle to support this. So there was no chance of a veto. But the U.S. just did not want the authorization for very good reasons. If you ask for authorization for an act, that implies that you need authorization, that you're not entitled to use violence at will. And it's not a wise move to do that. I mean, if you're, say, a mafia don and you want to collect protection money from someone, you don't get a court order. That would, even if you could, I mean, that would entail that you need some authority. And a really lawless, violent state that's committed with determination to act like an international mafia don is right to reject authorization. Now, there's even a word for it in the international affairs literature. It's called maintaining credibility. You have to maintain credibility. People have to be afraid of you. Now, that was actually the only, that was the official reason, both by Britain and the United States, for bombing Serbia, to maintain credibility. There were other reasons, but they weren't serious. And it's for the same reason the United States refused to seek extradition of Osama bin Laden and his associates. They might have been able to get it. The Taliban, in fact, offered it. But that was rejected summarily without comment, with total ridicule. And the U.S. didn't want extradition because extradition, to ask for extradition, again, entails that there's some authority that might rule on whether what you do is legitimate. And if you're the world ruler, you don't want any such you don't want any implication that there is such an authority. Well, all of that tells us quite a lot about international law, and you can kind of measure the significance that's given to international law in the intellectual culture by asking how often any of this comes up. The answer to that inquiry is zero, which tells you something. I'll put this aside, but let me just give you one last example. The last example is happened to be current yesterday, in fact. It has to do with the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Fourth Geneva Convention was executed in 1949. Its purpose was to formally criminalize the acts of the Nazis in occupied territories, Nazi-occupied territories. The power, the world power that has international responsibility for the Fourth Geneva Convention is Switzerland. It's what's called the depository power. And the International Committee of the Red Cross, based in Switzerland, is the responsible authority. Along with the rest of the world, the ICRC and Switzerland have repeatedly determined that the Fourth Geneva Convention applies to the Israeli-occupied territory. Israel alone votes against this in international forums. The U.S. abstains, not wanting to take such a clear position in violation of fundamental principles of international law, particularly given the circumstances that these were principles passed to criminalize Nazi atrocities. Switzerland, a couple of weeks ago, called for a meeting of the contracting parties on the Geneva Convention for December 5th, and it took place yesterday, to consider the application of the principles once again to the occupied territories. Notice that's highly relevant today. Notice also that they didn't call for a meeting of the high contracting parties because the U.S. refused to attend. It rejected its clear obligations under international law. All the high contracting parties, including the United States, are obligated to enforce the convention. The meeting took place. It was unreported in the United States. It was reported. I had a friend of mine did me a favor and did a database check of today's papers around the world. It was reported in the English-speaking world with one exception, the usual one. It's pretty difficult to miss the importance of this at the present moment, and it's another quite clear indication of the significance of international law and human rights in the elite intellectual culture. Well, again, easy to give lots of other examples. Let me just give one last one, because we got time, because it's interesting. There's a list of terrorist states. One of the terrorist states is Cuba. Nicaragua almost became a terrorist state. The United States warned a couple of weeks ago that if the population voted for the Sandinistas in the election that just took place, Nicaragua would also be identified as a terrorist state. To be identified as a terrorist state by the United States is no joke. A lot of things follow from that. So the population of Nicaragua understood the point and voted the right way, so we're all praising the election as a free election. Notice that, all of this passes without comment. I mean, the United States was condemned by the World Court and the Security Council for terrorism against Nicaragua, but it's determining that Nicaragua is a terrorist state, and nobody notices anything. Same with Cuba. Cuba is a terrorist state. Why? Well, because for 40 years, the United States has been carrying out terrorist acts against Cuba, beginning in October 1959. In fact, Cuba has been the target of more terrorism than probably any other country in the world, maybe all countries combined. So therefore, it's a terrorist state. And these crimes are not small. About a year ago, about 1,000 pages of documentation, declassified documents, were released from the Kennedy years. That's when the major atrocities started and took place. And a lot of them are about what's called Operation Mongoose, Kennedy's terrorist operations against Cuba, which were quite serious. They were known to be serious. These documents give more information about it. What's particularly interesting about the documents actually was pointed out by Harvard professor Jorge Dominguez in a review of the documents in the main professional journal, Diplomatic History. He pointed out that he's very anti-Cuba, incidentally. I think he's a Cuban exile, in fact, but a good scholar. He pointed out that in 1,000 pages of documents, which describe in some detail pretty serious atrocities, he said he could only find one phrase that raised the question of whether there was anything wrong with carrying out terrorist atrocities in Cuba. That was by a kind of a low-level staff officer who raised the question of whether it might harm U.S. interests if the crimes were exposed, and he was dismissed. The rest of the 1,000 pages don't mention it, and the historical record doesn't mention it. And there's no one bats an eyelash when Cuba's identified as a terrorist state by the state that has been carrying out terrorist actions against it for 40 years, some of them quite serious. One, in fact, came pretty close to leading to a nuclear war. Again, that's just normal practice, and it reflects the prevailing attitudes towards international law and human rights. The scholarly literature, incidentally, is quite the same. If you look at the standard scholarly histories of terrorism by, say, Walter LeCur or Paul Wilkinson and others, if you take a look in the index, you'll find that Cuba's listed. If you look up a lot of listings for Cuba, you check them out, and you'll find that each listing is of an allegation that Cuba might have been involved in supporting a terrorist act somewhere, or else it has to do with Cuban support for Angola when it was resisting South African attacks that were murderous and destructive and happened to be backed by the United States and England, so they're not terrorist acts. That's Cuban terrorism. What you won't find is any reference to the uncontroversial record of U.S. terrorism against Cuba. That's not listed. Again, standard scholarly practice. Well, let me say a couple things about human rights. It's not very easy to be all that optimistic about the world and about the directions into which it's heading, but there are encouraging developments, and we shouldn't forget them. One very promising tendency is the slow evolution over the years of a kind of a human rights culture among the general population. That accelerated quite sharply in the 1960s. The popular ferment of those years had a notable civilizing effect on the society in many respects. We see that at MIT. If you look at the composition of the student body today, it's quite different from what it was 40 years ago, as is the character of relations among students and faculty and among students and so on. These things are quite important. One significant feature was a greatly heightened concern for human rights. That includes rights of minorities, of women, rights of future generations. That's the driving force behind the environmental movement, which became quite important in the following years. There's also been considerable progress in formulating universal standards of human rights. Actually, the Universal Declaration of 1948 is the most noteworthy example, but there are others. Unfortunately, it's necessary to stress the word formulating. Implementation is quite a different matter. The way the system works, the Universal Declaration is a statement of principles only. The principles become applicable by means of what are called enabling conventions that are supposed to be established by the General Assembly. And these have to be signed and ratified by states to become applicable to them. Furthermore, even if they are signed and ratified, that has no force unless the conventions are actually applied. And at this point, since there's no enforcement mechanisms, we turn to the responsibilities of citizens. They have the responsibility of ensuring that the fine words do not remain what James Madison once called a mere parchment barrier in the way of tyranny and oppression. So they have to compensate for the lack of external enforcement mechanisms, which is the only way to give any substance to these pronouncements. Well, the extent to which this responsibility is undertaken is another measure of the commitment to international law and human rights. I'm not going to pursue that. I'll leave that as an exercise. It's a useful one for those who want to learn something about ourselves. Stress again that a profound flaw in the international system and an indication of the fragility of the commitment to human rights is the fact that the enabling conventions are toothless, even when they're ratified. Human rights are, as I mentioned, assigned a far lower value than the rights of investors and lenders. So corporations are granted extraordinary rights in current international investor rights agreements, far beyond ordinary persons. They had already been granted the rights of persons a century ago through radical judicial activism, and these rights were then conferred not on the corporation but on the corporate management that created a new absolutism, in the words of the leading legal historian of the process of transformation of American law, to transfer effective power to private tyrannies that are scarcely accountable to the public. That's Morton Horowitz of Harvard Law School. In the new international economic order today, these rights are extended far beyond those of persons. So General Motors, for example, can claim what's called national treatment in Mexico, but if a Mexican person of flesh and blood were to demand national treatment in Texas after crossing the border, assuming he made it alive, he wouldn't make out very well. The private tyrannies can also bring suit against governments to undermine regulations that were established to protect health or safety or the environment, and they can do that on the ground that the regulations may restrict their future profits. They are technical terms tantamount to expropriation. Under fanciful new legal doctrines of regulatory taking that have been created by ultra-right radical judicial activism. These aren't abstract possibilities. They've already been implemented, and the corporations win in the panels of trade representatives that operate in secret without rules of evidence or other judicial constraints. Persons of flesh and blood have no comparable rights. So it's not correct anymore to say that corporations have the rights of immortal persons. It's way beyond that in current legal doctrine. These recently concocted rights of investors and lenders, they are guaranteed by severe sanctions. Human rights can be freely violated with no penalty in the international system. There's no enforcement mechanism, just as there's none for the Geneva Conventions. There are for investor rights agreements, but even these enforcement regimes can hardly claim the mantle of justice. So, for example, the United States can threaten and indeed implement, if it wants, sanctions against Haiti, poorest country in the hemisphere, forcing it, as it has, to accept a flood of U.S. rice from agribusiness corporations that rely on massive public subsidies for about 40% of their profits, in fact. Which were sponsored with particular enthusiasm by self-declared conservatives, notably the Reagan administration, the policies that are extended by their successors have had very substantial effects in Haiti. They've destroyed the livelihood of the farmers who produce the primary subsistence crop in the poorest country of the hemisphere. In principle, Haiti can also threaten sanctions against the United States. That's permitted. For example, for subsidizing its rice exports, which is against World Trade Organization rules. Or, for example, for extradition. Haiti's been trying for years to extradite a major war criminal, Emmanuel Constant. He's a leading figure in the slaughter of maybe 4,000 to 5,000 people a few years ago during the Clinton years. This was under a military junta that had enjoyed the tacit support of the first Bush and the Clinton administrations while it tortured and murdered on a pretty impressive scale. Constant has already been sentenced by a court in Haiti, but in absentia, the U.S. refuses to surrender him, probably concerned about what he might reveal if he's brought to trial in person. And this is not the only such case. The refusal of a great power to extradite major criminals is routine, and it's so uncontroversial that it's unreported and unknown, as in this case, even though it's constantly reiterated. That's true even when the request for extradition for major crimes is requested by states that have long been allies and models of democracy, like Costa Rica, for example, particularly if the crimes would implicate the United States, as in that case they surely would. Haiti, Costa Rica, Cuba, Nicaragua, and others can, in principle, invoke sanctions against the United States. In the case of Costa Rica and Nicaragua, they could even appeal to an explicit decision of the World Court. But those are formal rights. They don't rise even to the level of ridicule in the real world. And that's why they're unmentioned and not part of history. Well, it's unnecessary to add, or it should be, that when the weak and defenseless suddenly become an official enemy, then the rules change quite radically. So when they offer to extradite a suspected criminal but ask for evidence first, that request is dismissed with total contempt. And the guardians of civilization react by driving miserable and entirely innocent people to mass starvation and death, always accompanied by ringing pronouncements of the unchallengeable justice of their cause on the part of distinguished intellectuals. I'm describing the last few weeks. Familiar. Takes a certain dedication to miss these salient features of past and present history. Well, with all of its serious flaws, the Universal Declaration does stand as an important achievement, and it should be regarded, I think, as a benchmark for future progress. There are, however, a number of illusions about it that ought to be dismantled. One illusion is that it's an expression of Western imperialism, that is, reflecting narrow, specific Western values. The history of the Universal Declaration reveals clearly that that's not the case. It had extensive contributions from Asian participants, roots in Asian cultures, and particularly in the anti-colonial and anti-fascist struggles that were dominant popular forces at the time. Asian relativists cannot reasonably plead that they were excluded and that the Universal Declaration is a form of Eurocentric cultural imperialism. That's just not true. Another illusion is that it's only Asian relativists who reject the universality of the Universal Declaration, which is defended with vigor and courage by the West, primarily its stalwart leader. That's a staple of Western commentary. I'll skip quotes. But it hardly withstands scrutiny. The Soviet representative, UN representative, Andrei Dushinsky, he formally accepted the Universal Declaration, but he was kind of like Dean Acheson. He said why. He said it's just a collection of pious phrases, so he was able to accept it. And those cynical words are widely quoted in the West, but not those of Reagan's UN ambassador, Jean Kirkpatrick, who derided the Universal Declaration as a letter to Santa Claus. Neither nature, experience, nor probability informs these lists of entitlements, which are subject to no constraints except those of the mind and appetite of their authors. Kirkpatrick was referring specifically to the socioeconomic provisions of the Universal Declaration. They have exactly the same status as all others, but they're irrelevant because they're rejected by the leaders of the free world quite explicitly. That's one of the reasons why the United States has one of the worst records in the world, even informally ratifying enabling conventions. And in fact, it's actually ratified none. Even the few that have been ratified have crucial reservations, and they're conditioned as inapplicable to the United States. They're non-self-executing in technical terms. You may have noticed this 2 years ago when Yugoslavia, in the middle of the bombing, brought to the World Court a charge of genocide against NATO charges. Absurd, but what was interesting is that the United States didn't argue against the charge. It simply argued before the court successfully that the U.S. wasn't subject to that charge because the World Court rules require that parties to a dispute both have accepted the principle. And when the U.S. finally did ratify the Genocide Convention after about 40 years, it specifically excluded itself from the charge. So therefore, the charge can't be brought against the United States in an international tribunal, and it was absolved correctly. U.S. opposition to the socioeconomic provisions is quite profound. The leading academic specialist on this topic, Philip Alston, he points out that after a brief detour under popular pressure in the 1970s, under Reagan, U.S. human rights policy, I'm quoting him, returned to the unqualified rejection of economic, social, and cultural rights as rights. And he quotes a high State Department official concerned with human rights and humanitarian affairs, Paula Dobriansky. She wrote to dispel what she called myths concerning human rights, the first of which is that the so-called economic and social rights constitute human rights. We say that the Universal Declaration is inapplicable, and therefore it's inapplicable by virtue of the rule of force again. George Bush, the first's ambassador, Morris Abram, he reaffirmed that stand. He described ideas formulated in the Universal Declaration as little more than an empty vessel into which vague hopes and inchoate expectations can be poured. They're a dangerous incitement and even preposterous. Abrams was addressing the UN Commission on Human Rights when he said that, and he was explaining Washington's rejection of what was called the right to development being debated then. This sought to guarantee, I'm quoting it, sought to guarantee the right of individuals, groups, and peoples to participate in, contribute to, and enjoy continuous economic, social, cultural, and political development in which all human rights and fundamental freedoms can be fully realized. The U.S. alone vetoed the declaration, thus implicitly vetoing Article 25 of the Universal Declaration, which it very closely paraphrased. And that position stands. It's also unchallenged and virtually unknown, apart from a few specialists. For these reasons alone, the United States is a leader of the relativist camp, rejecting the universality of the Universal Declaration, contrary to the huge literature that you read about this, which blames Asian relativists correctly, but they're not alone. When it serves power interests, the United States does depart from its rejection of the socioeconomic provisions of the Universal Declaration. So in building its case against the eventual use of force against Serbia, Washington submitted to the UN Security Council a resolution stating that deliberate impeding of the delivery of food and medical supplies to civilian populations constitutes violations of international humanitarian law, and those who commit or order the commission of such acts will be held individually responsible in respect of such acts. That's in the case of Serbia. Turning elsewhere. In the case of Cuba alone, every president of the United States since Kennedy is therefore individually responsible for such violations of international humanitarian law. The U.S. sanctions against Cuba are unique in the world in that they do not permit food and medicine to be sent. They impose severe sanctions on that. So it follows from the principle that the U.S. established in the case of Serbia, that every single president is subject to prosecution for that, or would be if it were not for the tacit agreement about selective enforcement. And that reigns with such absolute power among Western relativists, including virtually the entire intellectual and academic community, that even the simple facts are virtually undiscoverable, undetectable. You might try and see. Got to work to find them. 6 weeks ago, on World Food Day, October 15th, the UN Special Rapporteur for the Right to Food, official in charge of the issues of the right to food, Jean Ziegler, he reported that 100,000 people are dying every day from hunger. And this silent genocide, as he called it, is not the result of lack of means. It's their ample food supplies. It's the result of lack of will among the wealthy and the powerful, which is all quite accurate. Later, shortly after that, he announced the cancellation of the Second World Food Summit, which was scheduled for last month, for November. He canceled it because of lack of interest among the powerful. The pretty words do appear on paper. With a single exception, the members of the United Nations have formally accepted the principle that the right to adequate food is realized when every man, woman, and child, alone or in community with others, has physical and economic access at all times to adequate food or means for its procurement. It implies, still quoting, the availability of food in a quantity and quality sufficient to satisfy the dietary needs of individuals and acceptable within a culture that is indivisibly linked to the inherent dignity of the human person. But that remains a mere parchment barrier to starvation for almost a billion people, and the leader of the free world continues to uphold its principled rejection of the right to food. The U.S. is alone and refusing formally even to endorse this right. Well, all of this, again, passed without notice just in the last few weeks. Also unreported was the plea of the UN Special Rapporteur to the United States to stop the bombing of Afghanistan to permit desperately needed food deliveries to resume. He was echoing the pleas of leading aid organizations, the UN High Commissioner of Human Rights, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and others. There are warnings of a humanitarian catastrophe with millions of people facing starvation and disease were dismissed without comment and scarcely reported. The toll, whatever it'll be, will never be known, and it won't be investigated, at least if the past is any guide. I gave a couple of examples, and for the usual reasons. These are our crimes, therefore they're automatically expunged from history. We can forget about them. The Western powers insist on giving priority to civil and political rights. That's in direct conflict with the Universal Declaration. But there's a good deal of fraud even in that stand. In fact, they consistently reject these rights, selectively, as they choose. So consider, for example, Article 14 of the Universal Declaration. That declares that everyone has the right to seek and enjoy in other countries asylum from persecution. Now, that's a core principle of the civil and political rights regime which we claim to uphold. And it's been flatly rejected by every single U.S. administration, including the Carter administration. Notoriously, in the case of refugees from Haiti, they are driven back to their torture chamber by an illegal naval blockade.
You're listening to a talk by MIT Professor Noam Chomsky on human rights in the United States. This is on Welcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. We continue with the conclusion of the talk and the question period.